So we left off in our story.
An amazing place. What happened to those vast, powerful empires that had imposed their will upon Central and South America?
Wiped out by Spaniards.
They were wiped out. Now, were they completely killed off? No, what happened?
They were colonized.
Well, they weren't colonized.
Seized?
They were seized.
Or slave?
What?
Or slave?
Well, they were taken over. I wouldn't necessarily say they were enslaved. But how did they do it?
Fear.
Fear? That was a huge part of it. Fear. They had technology unlike the natives had never seen. Plus, it probably helped that they killed off the rulers, too. You know, you decapitate something. That's essentially what they did. They killed off the king of the Aztecs. They killed off the king of the Inca. But what about the everyday average person? Did they kill them?
They were sacrificing them for their gods, and they convinced those people that if they were misbehaved or whatever, they would be a part of that sacrifice.
Well, that's what the Aztec were doing to the people they conquered. But what about when the Spanish came in and overthrew the Aztecs? Did they continue human sacrifice? No. So in the minds of the people, all it was regime change. Because remember, were either of those empires in place for centuries on end? No, both the Inca and the Aztec were new. Both were less than 100 years old. So for the conquered people, it's like, okay, we'll get rid of these people who had conquered us, and let's give the new rulers a shot. All right. You, sir, who just came in, what's your name?
Sobex.
Were you here before?
No. I got back to Mass last Thursday.
Oh, you sent the email.
Yeah.
All right. What's your name?
Mark Johnny Hamlin.
Very good. All right. So, now we're in a situation where the Spanish toppled the governments, and now we have these empires. And they didn't seek to wipe them out. No. What they did was add them to their own empire. And that's essentially what the Spanish would do. They conquered, they took over, and they assimilated. They brought in all of the peoples in Central and South America. But what they did was impose themselves on these people. There was no democracy. There was no polling questions. Rather, they came in and set up shop. And all rule came top down. At the top of the mountain was the King of Spain. The King of Spain would essentially become an emperor. Although, in his capacity as ruler of Spain, he remained as king. This is Charles V. He would be one of the most powerful rulers in Europe ever. Because not only was he the King of Spain, now he was the ruler over these other empires. But what did this guy know? Nothing. He never came over here. He had no idea what was going on. So in ruling populations of millions of people, he decided to create a bureaucratic agency that would advise him. And this would be known as the Council of Indies. This body would be made up of mostly nobles, but eventually some merchants would get on it. And their job was to basically advise the king and tell him the conditions as they exist, to suggest policy. But of course, they couldn't tell the king what to do. No. They gave him advice, and then he made a decree. And their job was to implement it down to the ground level. But most of the people in the Council of Indies never came across the Atlantic either.
So they had were tasked with implementing order, laws, rules to govern the new world. So what did they decide to do? Well, they would appoint boots on the ground. Collectively known as viceroys, these would be Spanish-born, typically nobles, who would in fact get on a ship, sail across the Atlantic, and serve as the local source of authority. Now, because of the sheer scarce size of this new domain, what the Spanish did was they actually divided it into two. You had a northern territory that would become known as the Viceroyalty of New Spain. The seat of authority was Mexico City. And there would also be a Viceroyalty of Peru. And the seat of authority would eventually be in Lima. They had the power to enforce the laws of the king. Could they make their own laws? Generally, no. Generally, no. So this meant Spanish law from Spain also came across and was imposed upon these people. But of course, how could these two guys rule over all this territory? Truth be told, they couldn't. So what did the Spanish do? They were clever. They subdivided each into separate smaller zones known as audiencias. The highest official in the audiencia had a title of being a judge. And their job was to administer royal justice. The audiores. They could hear cases, and they could make decisions, rulings, based on the laws of Spain. Now, interestingly enough, they were charged with even listening to complaints by the natives and giving the natives justice. To break it down, to put it another way before I forget, the viceroyalties were kind of like the country. The audiencias were kind of like the states. But even this was a vast territory that could not be controlled by a single person. So even the audiencias were subdivided into what we would call counties. Gobernaciones. These were provincial officials who were charged with basically controlling the countryside that could make up several small towns, but most of it was just open jungle. They were to make sure that law and order was maintained. And then you had the different cities that were governed by the cabalitos, the city councils. These could be found in the big cities and the big towns. Each official came from Spain. And each one had a job to bring the law of the crown down to the local level. And report back if anything gets out of control. There's your imperial system. Questions? Well, how do they control millions and millions and millions of people? Why did even the conquered people of the Aztec or the Inca Empire just kind of go along with the flow?
Anybody know?
Food?
Oh, they were making the food.
Provisions of some kind they needed.
The natives?
Well, not yet.
They were there. They were making their own stuff.
Yeah, true.
They valued different resources?
What do you mean?
Like the Spaniards cared more for gold, minerals, precious gems, while they cared more about like fabrics, animals.
Okay, okay, so yeah, they have different values of importance, but how is that going to ensure that they obey the rules that the Spanish are making?
Fear.
What?
Fear.
Well, you only can use fear so much. You know, imagine you get made the official that's going to govern Paxton. You know, how are you going to make sure everyone in Paxton does what you want, particularly when they're completely foreign from you?
Take away their phone and their car.
No, I put everything in cursive.
And make their cars,
What? Yeah, how did the Spanish maintain control over these foreign populations? You can use some fear, but fear is not going to eventually going to work because, again, you got one Spaniard and you got thousands of these natives. What could they do if the Spaniard got out of control? Literally, what could they do to them?
Withhold something.
How about just kill them?
Oh, wow.
Could they use like a police system?
A what?
Like a police system almost. Have people watching them.
Who's going to want? Who's going to do that, though?
You know how you do it?
No.
You impose a sense of morality on them. You change the way they see the world. Because if everyone has the same morality, it's easier to control. So guess what? Secret weapon the Spanish brought with them. Jesus Christ.
Did that involve the Pope?
Well, interestingly enough, the Pope kind of made a sweetheart deal with the Spanish crown, and basically he gave up his authority over the way the church operated in the New World.
Whoa.
The Reconquista, the purging of Spain of Muslims and Jews, that mindset was used in the New World. So yes, you had the conquistadors, the soldiers, but shortly after the soldiers toppled the empires, in came the Catholic priests. And they brought with them the cross and scripture. And they launched a crusade to save the souls of these heathens. And by the way, they justified this in a simple visual idea. What good do the Aztec gods do for the Aztecs when the Spanish came with their god? Who won?
But that god would have survived thousands of years.
Which
Why
god?
Would they give it up so quickly?
Because they lost. The native gods lost. They could not protect the people from this new god that came from across the sea. And truth be told, if you look at the social history of many peoples when they change religions, usually it comes right after war. A war that was complete. A complete victory. So many natives simply converted because they sat back and said, wow, their god must be so stronger. Their stories must be more powerful. That book have the energy of the universe. And by the way, how efficient were they? Any of you have ethnic or cultural ties to Central, South America, the Caribbean? You talking Aztec?
No.
Are you doing human sacrifices?
I thought you said, like, if someone is from the Caribbean, I thought you said that.
What?
Like, if you got, like, connection with the Caribbean.
Right, yeah, yeah. So are you still speaking, like, native languages?
No.
What language do you speak?
Spanish.
Where do you think you got that from?
Spanish.
Okay. What religion are most of your family?
Catholic.
Yeah, why is that?
Spanish.
Yeah, Spanish.
The Spanish conquest of the New World was the most complete total conquest by one group of people over another group of people ever in the history of human civilization.
They completely eradicated the culture that was there and replaced it with Spanish culture, Spanish language, Spanish religion. It was a sweeping success. And as I did allude to Jane, you know, the church said nothing. Basically gave him his blessing. Because, by the way, guess what the Spanish crown did for the church? Quid pro quo. Well, think of all the ships of gold and silver that was going to Spain.
Wow.
Guess where some of it ended up?
Church.
Yep. And by the way, this is also going at the same time of the Reformation, which we're not going to talk about in here, which is not our time, when the Protestants appeared. And the Catholic and the Protestants are basically going to war against one another in Europe. So the Catholic priests came over like soldiers and they wanted to secure a sweeping success. And they did so totally. And quickly. Evidence seems to suggest that within less than a generation after the conquest, the natives abandoned their primitive languages, their primitive religions, and embraced Spanish culture. By the way, you know what modern sociologists refer to such practices? Genocide.
Oh, wow.
Questions? All right, now the question has to be asked, why did they do this? Why did they take control? Why did they basically transform the minds of the people? Why? What did the Spanish want out of this? For what? Wealth extraction. Wealth extraction. The crown, above all else, wanted to use this land to get more money, which would allow it to become more powerful. So the Spanish would implement a system known as encomienda, which is kind of like a tribute system, in which the natives would basically give to the Spanish, who would then ship it across the sea. How is this accomplished? Well, what the crown did was give land grants, just like they would do in Europe, to Spanish nobles who got in a ship and came over and took possession of land over here. And included in the land grant was anybody who happened to live on the land. Because once the king conquered it, it's his. So he gave it to these people.
Was it like England in that regard?
Yeah, it's kind of like the feudalist system, a vassalage. Because basically that's what the Spanish would do. They would come over, they'd take possession of the land, they'd build themselves a house, they would survey what they got on it, on the land, and they try to figure out a way to make something of value that they could ship back to the old world. Now, by the way, the natives were told they had to give to their new lord in exchange for the right to live on the land. So you can think of it almost like paying rent or paying taxes.
They were threatened as well.
Well, they were basically told, this is not your land anymore.
So it's not all like drug lords today in South America.
No, I suppose you can make an analogy.
Because they kind of do the same thing, except they kind of force the people to stay and actually to produce what they want them to produce.
Okay.
Initially, the Spanish were content to take whatever was there already.
Wow, this sounds a lot like slavery.
Yeah.
But legally speaking, it was not. And the reason why the natives were not, in fact, enslaved anywhere in the New World was because of a weird occurrence. Queen Isabella, when she gave the land grant to Columbus, and as long as she was alive and she signed off on more grants for more conquistadors to come over, she explicitly stated that the natives would be treated as free vassals of the crown.
In other words, citizens. If they became Catholics.
Because under the laws of the church that went all the way back to the Crusades, Christians could not be enslaved.
Non-Christians could. So the natives could stay in their villages. They could keep producing whatever it was they were producing. They just had to give a cut to the Spanish. Ironically, that's the very same system that the Aztecs used.
So for the people that were there, it was nothing different. In fact, it was better. Because you know the one thing the Spanish never came to extract?
People.
Yeah, they never came to extract human sacrifices. So it seems, again, this is based on the accounts by the first Spanish that were there, the natives, particularly in the Aztec Empire, loved the fact that the Spanish were there.
Because the Spanish took less than the Aztecs did.
And that's one another reason why they were willing to embrace the new language, the new religion. Because the Spanish came as saviors. There's also one other interesting little thing that manifested early on.
Because the Spaniards who came over were men, exclusively, they needed to do with ladies the things that men like to do.
So here's the catch. Under the laws of the Spanish Empire, if anyone had even a drop of Spanish blood in them, they did not have to fall victim to the encomienda. So they could, in fact, get a land grant. They could own land. And they could get tribute from the people on the land. So guess what a lot of the local native chieftains did? Well, the same practice that they had in the Inca Empire. Young, attractive women. There you go. Full house today. Who are you?
Bruce.
Who?
Bruce.
Is this your first day?
No, it's your last.
I didn't write it down. Did you come late last class?
Yeah, that was my first time.
Wow. That's probably why. So Bryce is here. All right, you sir, what, you who got lost, what's your name? Jordan came in, Bryce came in, he did. Yeah.
So, questions?
with the exception of the mixed race people
and the Spaniards who came over, the whole purpose of the system was to create wealth,
to extract something of value that could flow across the Atlantic and make profit in the mother country. Mercantilism.
The biggest bang for their buck came in South America, where the Spanish took over a system of wealth extraction,
highly, highly specialized, created by the Inca.
The Spanish would call it the Mita system.
If you recall when I talked about the Inca Empire, one of the things that the Inca used to do is basically take the people and make them produce what it was they wanted to produce. And at times they would engage in ecological colonization. They'd basically pick up an entire village and move them to wherever the goods was that the empire wanted them to produce.
There was also labor taxation, where the people expect to work for the state, building roads, building infrastructures.
Well, the state also extracted precious stones, precious metals.
Well, when the Spanish came over, there were mines that were operating. It had been operating for decades. So the Spanish simply took over and kept the miners mining.
And the amount of wealth they extracted is mind-boggling. It's estimated that in 100 years of operation, this is just from the mines, this doesn't include stuff that they confiscated, the Spanish took 17 billion grams of silver, 180 million grams of gold,
countless tons of emeralds and rubies and other precious stones.
You could not eat these. So literally they were harvested. Give or take about one-fifth stayed as profit for the Spanish who were running these systems and also to maintain, you know, local infrastructure. But four-fifths of it was put on boats and sailed across the Atlantic. Any of you have these little idiot devices? I can guarantee you that some of the silver that's used in the components is remnant silver that was extracted by the subjects of the Mita system. But unfortunately, a lot of the mines would dry up, particularly when you start getting into the 17th and 18th centuries.
But that was okay, because the Spanish were able to make money other ways.
By growing surplus foodstuffs. Because you know which is something that's amazing?
Many of the vegetables that we enjoy came from the New World. Corn, tomatoes, potatoes, coffee, but coffee's not just native here.
But there were a lot of crops that we have in our diet and has been in the global diet for centuries that were harvested first here
because they didn't exist elsewhere in the world.
Food would be highly profitable. But you also needed to produce food for the workers. So there would actually be two forms of agricultural entities that would operate here. One would be haciendas.
Some of them would actually morph into towns. But originally they were small, self-contained farms. Kind of like a lot of the farms used to be in New England. Where basically the owner would produce what was necessary to feed himself, feed his family, feed his workers, and would also generate all of the commodities to make a house, you know, to make the tools, anything they needed. And if there was a little left over, then they might sell it. And they would use the surplus to feed, you know, workers on other agribusinesses. Then there were the agribusinesses that produced goods just for cash, cash crops. Plantations. Unlike a hacienda, which were produced diversified items, plantations typically were carved in the middle of the jungle and would produce single crops for harvesting and shipping across the sea. Sugar, coffee, tobacco, cotton, all raised on plantations. Now here's the kick. If a native happened to be living on a part of land that was part of the hacienda, they would kind of become like farmhands. So they would work with the Spanish overlord and they would basically produce what was necessary and they would all kind of communally share whatever was produced. But the foodstuffs on plantations were not harvested for consumption. Pay was low. Labor was intensive. And what often happened is many of the locals would just say, well, I'm taking my ball and I'm going home. They simply said they didn't want to work in those conditions, so they left. They ditched and went into the jungle. There was nothing they could do. So, the Spanish needed labor to work the plantations to maximize profit. Plus, there's one other thing that I don't remember if I mentioned it. I probably did last class, but I'll just throw it out there now. I did talk about the impact of disease, right? Does anyone remember if I talked about disease?
No, I didn't.
So, the Spanish brought with them, unbeknownst to them, 30 different types of diseases that were not present in the New World. Things like smallpox, influenza, malaria. Even the bubonic plague was brought over. These were diseases that the natives had no natural resistance to. So what ended up happening as the diseases spread, sometimes entire populations and villages would be depopulated. They'd all be dead. If you ever have a chance to read through some of the stories of the Spanish conquistadors, countless times they talked about going into a village that they had heard was thriving and everyone would be dead. Now, we can't say that the Spanish engaged in any biological warfare, because the Spanish didn't know. But when you are exposed to a disease for the first time, and your body's never been exposed to it before, you're more likely to suffer the worst symptoms, potentially leading to death. But if you've been exposed to it, then your body can build up some resistance. Well, the natives had no resistance, and depending upon where in the New World you're talking about, you had a death rate within the first two generations of somewhere between 30 and 90%. It's believed, for example, that the Aztec population was about 15 million at its height. Well, by 1600, that dropped down to 2.5 million. Believe that the population of the Inca Empire was about 10 million, go to about 1600, just three generations later, and that population dropped to about 2.3 million. One of the hardest hit regions was the island of Hispaniola, the first island that Columbus landed on and made a colony. It's believed there were about 250,000 people living on that island when Columbus got there. But by 1515, when the governor tried doing a census, that number dropped to about 10,000. Then when they did it again in 1550, they couldn't find any of the Tiano people on the island anymore. So, if you're trying to establish agribusinesses that's labor intensive and you have a declining local population, where are you going to get workers from?
country.
Absolutely. And this would give rise to a very interesting byproduct of the Spanish conquest of the New World, which today is known as the transatlantic slave trade. All right, as I told those of you who are here on the first day, I teach history. I don't teach feelings. I never try to say anything that intentionally is offensive. I just teach the facts. But sometimes the facts make us feel uncomfortable. I'm just telling you the way it is. And truth be told, slavery has always existed. As long as human civilization has existed, and in one form or another, it will always exist. Literally, the first cuneiform tablets, when writing was first invented, they found tablets containing basically inventories of, I guess, we could call them the pimp, keeping track of his records. Because the first form of slavery was prostitution, in which a woman would be forced to give her body for profit. Labor would also come shortly thereafter. You take someone and you make them work for you. It has existed everywhere on earth. There is not a corner of this earth that has not seen a form of slavery. And it has never, ever, ever been race dependent. Every single race has been enslaved. And coincidentally, every single race has also acted as slavers. They've held slaves. And I'll give you one interesting little fact. The English word for slave derives from the word Slav. The Slavs are the people who live in and around Eastern Europe, south of Poland, north of the Balkans. We're talking the Bosnians, the Croatians, the Czechs. Those people are Slavs. The word was institutionalized when the Mongolians, who had converted to Islam, began raiding the villages and selling the people off. Why do I mention that? I'm Slovakian. And I got a real weird, interesting twist. Because I'm also half Austrian. So we have, through genealogy, discovered that there was a point where one of my ancestors, an Austrian noble, actually owned one of my Slavic ancestors. So go figure. Another interesting fact was that the slaves that would be brought over here to work on the plantations in the Spanish parts of the world largely came from Africa. But it wasn't the Europeans that broke into Africa. Originally, it was the Muslims. Because in the Quran, it is said that Allah allows for non-Muslims to be enslaved. And the Muslims, particularly with the establishment of the Umayyad Caliphate, the first post-Muhammad empire, they made their way across North Africa and began penetrating Western Africa. And basically procuring human beings to serve as laborers. And then they would march them across North Africa and sell them anywhere within their empire. This dates back to around 650 AD. Now, FYI, it's estimated, that the Muslims captured and sold somewhere between 20 and 40 million human beings from the 7th century all the way up to the 19th century. So they took a lot.
One other quick factoid. From just 1500 to 1900, the Muslims also captured about 2 million Europeans. Because not only were they going into Africa to get people, they were also raiding the coast of Europe. There's an interesting GIF, an animated graphic that I saw online, that you can actually see recordings of every Muslim strike on Europe during this time period. Just about the entire coast of Western Europe is dotted. They went as far as Ireland. Land, kind of like the Vikings did. They would pull up, they would land, they would go attack a household, grab people, and sail off and go sell them. Ferocity at its most. But here's the interesting thing. How did the Muslims get them? Through trade. They made deals with other Africans. Because the African chieftains were no different than the European kings. They wanted more, more, more. They wanted more land. They wanted more money so they could get more power. And at some point, they figured out the best way to get more land is to get rid of your enemies. So it wasn't the whites or the Muslims that went and captured the Africans. No, the African chiefs in one tribe would order their warriors to go and capture the people of a neighboring tribe. Abduct them, and then you trade them in slave trade markets. So when the Portuguese started going down the coast of Africa in the 15th century, I already said that they'd made contact with powerful African tribes. They also happened to make contacts with some of the slave traders. Because not a single European got off a ship and went into the African woods and captured a single African. Somewhere between 10 and 12 million were basically bought. They were taken from their homes by Africans, exchanged to the Europeans, put on a ship, and sailed across the Atlantic Ocean to engage in labor here. And how much did they cost? Well, it depended. This extraction lasted for 400 years. So depending upon where exactly you're talking about, when exactly you're talking about, it shifted from gold dust to guns to beads, alcohol, commodities that the Africans did not have. By the end of the slave trade, right around the time of the U.S. Civil War, though, it was cash transactions. Also, where they came from shifted. Again, you can't see the timeline. I don't know if the timelines are on there. But you can see they came from all different directions, and they would come over. But here's an interesting graphic. Just under half would go to Brazil. The other half would go into the Spanish domains. And notice, only a tiny, tiny little line would actually make it up to here. I know I've heard some particularly political activists that said, oh, America's responsible for slavery. That's factually incorrect. Not even close. Only 4% of the slaves that were taken came to British North America. Wasn't the Americans who invented it. It was the British system that we inherited. And who was actually doing it? Well, that shifted. First, it was the Portuguese. Then the Spanish would get involved. But then later, the Dutch and the French and the English would all get in on this. could make deals with the Africans, bring down a boat full of commodities, exchange, fill it up with human cargo, ship it across the sea. All right, this is all out of order. The Portuguese was the first. All right, that's fine. Oh, here's another. Oh, I should have done this one first. Wait, I thought all the Europeans were Catholics. Where in the Bible does it say that God condones one man owning another? Any of you ever found that passage in Scripture? I've read the Bible multiple times. I haven't found it yet either. Then why did they do it? Why did the Christians get involved? Islam, the Quran, says it's fine. But why were the Christians doing it? Well, I know, but money. But again, Christians, aren't we supposed to live by the messages contained in Scripture and the Gospel? Don't roll your eyes at me. Don't be a typical American Catholic. All right. No, truth be told, when the opportunity was first presented to the Portuguese king at the time, Afonso V, was challenged by this. He felt morally troubled. So as all the kings used to do prior to 1500, he sent word to the Pope at the time, Nicholas V. And he asked the Pope, okay, Your Holiness, we have an opportunity to get labor. We've made contacts with these African chieftains. They want to give us human beings. We don't really have much need for human beings. Plus, isn't this a sin? Well, the Pope actually said, and I quote, that it is the right of any Catholic to, and I quote, reduce any Saracens, pagans, and any other believers to hereditary slavery. So it's not the Bible that condoned it. It was a pope. Remember where I started? The pope was kind of, the church was kind of corrupt. Way off its mission. Well, there you go. But I am a devout Catholic. I will give my church some props. Because in 1537, the great reformer pope, Pope Paul III, actually officially changed the position of the church. And he declared that all peoples, even those outside the faith, should not be deprived of their liberty. But do that sarcastic response there like you did. By that point, the ships were already going across, the plantations were opening up, and the gold was starting to flow. What would you do for a Klondike bar? I bet you I could get you, any of you, to violate your sense of morality with a large enough stack of bills. Guaranteed.
Every person has a price. So even though the Pope was trying to say, look, you're doing it wrong, 80 years later, people were like, la, 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 la.
And at the end of the day, in the eyes of the Europeans who were procuring these human beings, they were just engaging in business. You know, at the end of the day, how is trading or bartering for a laborer different than going to Walmart and picking up a new pair of sneakers? There's something you want that you need to use, so you're going to give the cashier money to get it. And then once you get the shoes, you're going to wear them and use them. Well, logically speaking, in the minds of the Europeans, this was no different. Except instead of getting a cow or an ox or a mule or shovel, now you get someone who's going to be able to pull the ox or the cow and hold the shovel. So the first Africans were brought over as laborers to work on the plantations that were opening up. They would come to essentially replace the natives who were largely dying because of disease.
And as I said, between 10 and 12 million were brought over in a 400-year period. 35% went to Brazil, 24% went to the South and Central America, and 37% went to the Caribbean.
Here's another interesting observation. If I say the name David Ortiz, do you know who I'm talking about? Where did he come from? What country is the country of his birth?
DR.
The DR. Doesn't he look a lot like the people who actually come from Africa? I told you, the natives were completely wiped out. They would subsequently be replaced.
So that's the reason why many of you who have ethnic ties to Central, South America, the Caribbean, you also have African blood in you.
Because of this. Because ultimately, the slaves were not done because of racism or anything like that. No. The Spanish king gave these land grants to the nobles, and the nobles were told, you got to make something of value out of it. And the only way to make something of value out of it was to get laborers to produce the goods.
I have to say, I think it's helpful. I had a brother-in-law that called him the Black Irishman. Now we know why.
Yeah.
Because what's known in Ireland is blonde, red hair, and his hair was blacker than mine.
Yeah.
Now I know why.
Well, our ancestors were getting it on everywhere they could.
Nice. All right. Now, here is the last thing. I want you to remember this. It had nothing to do with race. It was about serving a purpose. And the biggest thing it served was the fact that the Africans could do something the natives could not. Get sick. The same diseases that depopulated Central and South America in the islands had been present not only in Europe, but Africa as well. So if one of these Africans got the flu, they got sick. But you know what they did not do? They did not die.
Just like the Spaniards, they would get sick, they would not die. How much profit can you produce if you die?
Wasn't something in their genetic makeup?
No, the malaria, the influenza, smallpox, the diseases you always used to ravage the Euro-Asian African landmasses. Because there was constant global contact with one another.
Okay.
Disease would spread. All right, questions? That's probably the most touchy subject that we cover this semester. All right. But at the end of the day, remember, it was all about the Benjamins. That's what it was all about. It was about supercharging this mercantilist empire system that was being created. And what this did was create a third leg. So maybe when you were in high school or middle school, you learned about it as the triangle trade. Because before it used to be a, you know, back and forth, but now you have a third stop that gets added on. And so just to use my little cheesy graph that I gave you before, we're going to add a third component to it. We're going to bring Africa over there. And to a degree, this still goes on. Resources are being harvested over in the colonies. They're put on boats. They're shipped to the motherland. And the motherland is still using those resources, making them into stuff, shipping them back to the colonies to buy those resources. Still occurring. But now some of the stuff is going from the mother country to Africa. Because the African chieftains, they want wine, they want beer, they want guns. And those goods, of course, are used to buy the laborers, which are going to be brought back to the New World and basically produce the resources. And again, I will emphasize the word supercharge.
Because if the colonies were not producing enough, then just go get another boatload. Or another boatload. Or another boatload. And they would keep producing and producing and producing. Why? Crown wanted more. Crown wanted more.
The whole system was designed to generate wealth, which the crown could tax and fill their coffers.
And everybody was doing it. That's the other thing.
Now, just, yes?
So slavery really started in South America?
No, slavery existed wherever human beings have existed. But slavery in the New World, once it was brought over, yeah, it was South America.
Okay, and the colonies got it from South America?
Yes. Well, no, actually the first group, oh, now here's the other thing, okay. So I'm sure you all heard of like 1619, you know, when the first 20 came to Jamestown. Truth be told, they didn't were not considered slaves. They were actually on a Dutch ship that got blown off course, landed in Jamestown for repairs. So what the Dutch captain was forced to do was actually have to exchange the commodities, the human beings, for fresh water, wood, and supplies to fix the ship. But England at the time did not allow slavery in the colonies. So the first 20 who came over were the same as most of the British who came over. They were treated as indentured servants.
So basically, somebody bought their contract, and in exchange, they got housing, they got food, they got clothes, and they would expect to work for 5 or 10 years. They were treated the same as everybody else. But you know how slavery began in the British colonies?
One of those 20 who managed to survive a vicious Indian raid was able to get his hands on a farm. And he managed to pick up a couple of indentured servants
under a system that used to operate called the headrent system.
Well, one of his indentured servants was an African. The African claimed, "I did my 7 years.
You need to let me go free." Well, the landowner, who also was an African, said, "No, you still owe me more time."
So he took him to court and sued and used tribal law, law that came from Africa, that said when a man owned another man, that person was his property until released. The British judge sat back and said, "Well, this is a cultural thing. I'm not getting involved." And he granted a right of ownership to the African. Guy's name, Anthony Johnson. You can look him up. How about that for messed up?
All right. So now we know what the Spanish were doing. Generating wealth, doing everything they can to maximize production. What were the Portuguese doing?
Well, they went a different route, both literally and figuratively.
Instead of conquering
and exploiting like the Spanish did,
what the Portuguese decided to do is try to take control of the flow of goods. So the Spanish wanted to be the owner-operators, but the Portuguese wanted to be like UPS or FedEx. They wanted to own the ships that transported the goods. They didn't want to be in the production business. Because after all,
everybody.
What?
Everybody was in the production business. So if they were to own the boats, then they people would need to pay them to ship the stuff.
100%, you got it.
What do you say?
Everybody else was producing. The Portuguese figured that out. But nobody had ships capable of bringing goods globally. The Portuguese did. So what did they do? They used the ships that they had, they went and got the stuff, and they brought it back and sold it. And you know how much money you can make being the middleman? Huge mega bucks.
How is this different or similar to pirates?
Not by much.
Okay.
Let me finish telling you the story, and then we can talk about it at the end.
Okay.
All right. So, we know what happened to Columbus. Absolutely convinced he made it to Asia, but of course we know he was wrong. Well, at around the same time Columbus was coming over, absolutely convinced he got to Asia, well, lo and behold, the Portuguese actually did. Taking advantage of the slow knowledge that was gained, in 1498, Vasco da Gama sailed around the Cape of Good Hope and would eventually make his way up the eastern coast of Africa, arriving in India. Amazing. This trip took him 5 months. He had with him a small flotilla of 4 ships. He would end up losing one along the way. Question. How can you go by sea for 5 months in a wooden box? What is the one or two things that all people need?
Food and water.
Food and water. What? You're on the ocean. Can't you just drink it?
Too salty.
No. Did you think they had desalinization machines back then? No. They had no idea. You can't drink it. You got to get dehydrated. And then what about food? Did they have refrigeration?
No. They had salt food.
And salt their food, but okay, you're in the ocean, that's the salt air, now you're just eating nothing but salted food. Oh, cholesterol levels must have been through the roof. Lots of times the crew would get what's called scurvy.
Lack of vitamin C,
yeah. So they needed like fresh citrus to kind of keep them from dehydration. Where are they going to get it from? Well, I can tell you, as they went down this side of Africa, it wasn't a problem. Because the Portuguese had already made friends with all of the powerful African chieftains. They knew who they could deal with. And they could simply go and exchange, barter for exchange, get fresh food, fresh water. But now they're entering the unknown. Now, does anyone recall the reason why the Portuguese were trying to get around Africa? Who were they trying to avoid? The Muslims that had taken control of the Middle East. So we're going to go around them to avoid war. Well, lo and behold, they come around the eastern coast and they start going up. And guess what they discover?
Bananas?
No, most of the towns are actually controlled by Muslims.
Sorry.
Because unbeknownst to the Europeans, Islam had spread down the eastern coast of Africa. So the whole reason why they went around was to get away from the Muslims, and lo and behold, the only place they can get fresh food, fresh water, is from the Muslims. Problematic, no?
Wow.
Well, we have to be honest. The hard thing about teaching a survey class is sometimes it sounds like I'm making generalizations, but we always have to take a step back and acknowledge. I'm just trying to make it short and swift and simple. Because the reality of what da Gama and his crew faced was, yes, there were some Muslims that wanted to jihad him. They wanted to kill him because he was a Christian. But not all Muslims are like that. Just like not all Jews are away, or not all Christians are away. Many people on this earth, the vast majority, are more interested in... Can I do it without ripping it? This is Professor Lemanic, looted my wallet. Normally I have a big roll, but at least she left me with an Alexander Hamilton. This, by the way, is the majority of people's favorite color on earth. Money. So, da Gama, yeah, he was a Christian. Yeah, he was trying to get around the Muslims. Yeah, but there were some Muslims that were willing to do business. In fact, he made note, don't stop at this town, but this town's okay. But when you put it all together, this was huge, because now the Portuguese had, through decades of exploration, had enough contacts to get around Africa. And they knew they could do it and not die or fall off the earth. No one thought the world was flat. Now, with the help of the Sultan in Malindi, he would give him a pilot who would help him sail across the Indian Ocean and arrive at the equivalent of Disney World, an Italian port called Calicut. Calicut was an ancient city that had been there for hundreds of years. And it was controlled by people who worshipped fantastic gods, the Hindus. And when they arrived, the Gomer and his crew, who were just looking for something of value that they could get to pay for the whole trip, remember the 20-80 split? 20% had to go to the crown, they could keep 80%. Well, lo and behold, when they went through the markets, their eyes must have been bug-eyed. Anything that they could imagine, spices, textiles, lacquerware, ivory, anything, in quantities, seemingly limitless supply, was there. Bless you.
Bless you.
And the people who were peddling these goods were willing to do business with anyone. Didn't matter what religion you were, didn't matter what race you were. They only wanted the same thing that I like having lots of when my wife doesn't pilfer my wallet. Let's do business. Now, Dagama had it covered. He had a whole bunch of stuff the Africans liked. He had cast iron pots. He had coral. He had glass beads. All of these things, you know, the Africans ate it up. He had wool. But when he brought it into the marketplace, the merchants were like, what is this crap? Wool? Wool. Any of you have a wool sweater? Like an actual wool sweater? Do you like wearing it?
When it's cold.
When it's cold, it's helpful, or when it's damp. But generally speaking, yeah, kind of itchy. Could you wear it now? Could you wear it come July? No. So yeah, wool has certain purposes at times, but generally speaking, it's not all purpose or comfortable, like say, silk. Now don't take offense at me, ladies, but I'm sure all the guys can agree. Silk boxes, yeah? Just saying. So the merchants were like, we don't want what you have. What you have is worthless. Which, of course, caused all the guys to freak out. We just spent 5 months, we have a ship full of this stuff, and we can't get rid of it? Now what are we going to do? Well, as luck would have it, Dagama had an emergency stash. The crown had given him a small chest of silver to be used in cases of emergency. Well, as it turns out, silver was rare in India. In fact, it was more valuable than gold. So when Dagama whipped out a small bag of coins, all the merchants were like, dude, let's do business. While he couldn't fill up all his ships, the three ships that he had, he managed to buy enough
that he covered the entire expense of the expedition 60 times over. But this would set a precedent that would remain in place for the next 400 years. The Asians didn't want European stuff, but the Asians would be willing to do business for the Benjamins. All right. Now, what are some of the takeaways that we can have from Da Gama's success? Well, he proved to what Emmanuel said. He showed that the Portuguese had tech that no one else had. There were no other people on earth that had the ability to sail across the earth and come back again. So the European ships, the masts, the riggings, that all proved perfect. Plus, we have the profit incentive. Always remember, what would you do for a Klondike bar? And they now can get around Islam. As we're going to see for parts 2 and 3 in this class, we're going to see what the Europeans would do when we get to the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. When they had the Industrial Revolution, and they were able to take advantage of their technological advantage to basically topple regimes. This is the door opens the first crack. And I'm sure if you could show the people alive then history books to see what would happen, they would never believe it. But it would be significant. The other thing that I got to throw out is that Da Gama learned that the whole reason why they went that far was pointless because the Muslims were in India as well. Because unbeknownst to the Portuguese, going back to the 10th century, just before the Crusades, the Muslims began going through Persia and eventually would make their way into India. Not as conquerors, but as merchants. So, the Muslims control the land route to get to Europe, but now the Portuguese control the sea. Who's going to make more money? Well, we'll find out next class. Questions? Yes.
What did Da Gama do with all the bits across India that he couldn't trade?
Sorry?
Did Da Gama end up trading all the wool and iron that he brought to India, or did he trade all the wool back?
Some of it he gave away. Some of it he did bring back. Because when they got back to the west coast of Africa, he wasn't going to give any of the real valuable stuff to the Africans to get food and water. All
right, guys and gals, don't blow away. Topics are due on Friday, don't forget. See y'all on Thursday.